How's everyone?
Good.
I'm going to try something. I was going to read some poems and then read something out of this book, but I'm going to try to read something like brand new, if that's cool. Or I'm going to try to read two brand new things, if that's cool. I'm going to try to get through them both, but we'll see what my time looks like after the first one. Does anyone know who Al Jolson is? Al Jolson's kind of the most notable performer of American blackface. Does anyone know who William Henry Lane is? William Henry Lane is a lot less notable, but he's the most notable black performer of American blackface. Does anyone know the piece, 13 Ways of Looking at a Black Bird? No? Cool. Well, I'm going to read two things. Hopefully I'll get through them both. 13 Ways of Looking at Al Jolson. One, at an old piano in the jazz singer, his back arched, lips pushed together as if awaiting a kiss, playing the piano but looking backwards into the eyes of the Eugenie Besserer, who by that point was 60 years old and old enough to play Jolson's mother. Jolson's suit is pristine and his hair is neat but thinning. As he plays, his eyes become their own versions of instruments, bouncing skyward in a symphony of directions before always returning to his mother, searching for her character's approval. When he finishes the first verse, he turns his body to her and asks, "Did you like that, Mama?" When she nods affirmatively, he joyously says, "I'm glad of it. I would rather please you than anybody I know of." And it must bear mentioning that Jolson is white in this moment. Jolson is always white, though sometimes the whiteness is tucked underneath something else the way it sometimes can be, tucked under a coat of dark, dark makeup or power or a whole entire country. But in this part of the jazz singer, Jolson is white because this is the part of the movie that is supposed to be both human and tender. If Jolson is ever sympathetic, it is here, talking about how many birds will cover the sky when he achieves his dreams and can buy his mother whatever she desires, a dress to match her eyes, which, in this moment, he asks her to close so that he can steal a kiss before promising that he'll give it back someday. It is striking in movies this old how the tropes of familial love trend so closely to the tropes of on-screen romantic love now, set in another era, perhaps even one just a decade beyond this one. Jolson could just as well be outside the window of a woman he was courting, making the same wild-eyed promises. A still of this scene was used in one of the two promotional posters for the film, painted carefully to capture Jolson's striking facial features. In the moments when Al Jolson's white face is on screen and obscured by nothing, dark or otherwise, I imagine what it must be like to be truly beloved, regardless of what you are capable of transforming into. The jazz singer is entirely about this first, a young singer who runs away from his home and changes his name so that he can reinvent himself, a myth unfurling into another myth and another until all that is recognizable are the sparkling white eyes jumping towards the heavens and falling back upon someone, anyone, willing to look into them. Two, there are a lot of things that the people who wear blackface get wrong, but the one that not many people talk about is the way they slather the makeup on their faces as if they've never seen a black person before. Most of the time, the makeup pitch black and wildly uneven were smeared haphazardly over the skin with no attention to detail. I have thought before about how this feels like an additional insult positioned atop the obvious insult, how even an attempt to mimic cannot be done with enough care for the skin of the mimicker. Because I cannot take my skin off, I ask my homies for a skincare routine. And the group chat sprawls with names of products and links to them. I wander at Whole Foods and ask Safia exactly which exfoliating loofah glove I should purchase, sending photos of my findings in the group chat. Jason tells me that I can't go wrong with Cetaphil as a base. All I know is that I've had the good fortune of having largely great skin for 3 decades with no real work put into it, and I'm looking to see what might be the fullest potential for my skin's immortality. I come from an ageless people, after all. At most black functions I've been to, someone pulls me aside, points to some alleged elder, and asks me to guess how old the elder is. And when I guess too young, they throw out some age bordering on the absurd, one that seems even more foolish as the sunlight gallops across an absence of wrinkles during a vigorous dance or a laugh rattles the wind. I most love the mythology of the ageless blacks, how it truly doesn't crack unless you give yourself over to do the bidding of some evil. Like we've all been blessed, but might have to sell ourselves to the devil, who will surely want his, and in return, the aging process starts and accelerates. Stacey Dash didn't look a day over 25, and she was running in slow motion through the Chicago airport, trailed by Kanye West in a music video. But 1 year working for Fox News, and the people say she's looking every minute of her age, and the decade she kept at an arm's length for all that time finally returned, and Lord, did it come to collect. And all I know is, I'm gonna be on the wrong side of 30 soon, and I'm trying to keep my skin and my spirit clean. And so, I spend way too much money on way too many products that I've never seen and don't understand. I apply my own facial mask, slathering on the white cream unevenly, too aggressively on my cheeks and forehead, but lightly around my eyes, my hand guided by even more anxiety than usual. And from underneath my coated eyelids, I scroll through some social media timeline or another. Black people on the internet are upset about a party at some school. The theme was the hood, or some iteration of what white people think the hood is. None of the party's attendees were black, but most took measures to make themselves black. Darkness was achieved by what seemed like all measures, shoe polish, makeup, even markers. The attendees wore large fake gold chains and massive white tees swung to their kneecaps. They twisted up their fingers in homage to the gangs of their wildest imaginations. Sunglasses and sneers adorned their faces, hiding poorly behind the splotches of brown. And what a predicament. Me, looking upon this with my face caked in some white substance which promises to keep my skin young, and boys, younger than I was in that moment, throwing whatever they could on their young skin to make it darker. Despite its history and its harm and the many echoes of the violence it summons, the thing about blackface that most clearly stung arrived in this moment, looking upon the scene of recklessly adorned white skin while taking delicate care to help my own dark skin flourish. This is what they think we look like. 3. I have had the dream where I hold Al Jolson wearing a dark coat of blackface under the water of an old bathtub in a black and white film. I do not know how I arrive in the scene, but I arrive with my hands on his shoulders, pushing him down below the water, which seems endless from my angle. In the dream, he's wearing the brown suit he wears while playing the piano in The Jazz Singer. That movie was in black and white, as is this dream, but I know the suit is brown. I know the suit is brown because I have, in my waking hours, stared at the poster from the film, which is painted in color. I know the suit is brown because on the poster, Jolson's face is not brown. The suit is the only interruption of white on his whole body. In the dream, Jolson does not struggle when I hold his head under the water. His eyes stay open. I scrub at his face with my hands until the scrubbing becomes clawing, trying to remove the layer of caked-on dark skin so I can address the man underneath. In the dream, I don't know what I would say to Al Jolson if I could peel the mask from his face, but I keep peeling, and Jolson does not fight, even as I swipe my fingers across his eyes. His eyes, surrounded by the darkness of his makeup, gleam from underneath the water, and when I push him down far enough, his face vanishes entirely, or at least I think it does. In a dream, nothing is tactile, even in a dream that arrives and arrives again. Only the smallest details remain. I know the tub is old, one of the tubs with massive claws at its feet. In the background, a version of Blue Skies is probably playing, but in this dream, I have convinced myself that it isn't Jolson's version because it's being sung by a woman, which means I tell myself it is Ella Fitzgerald, who, I imagine, would also want me to scrub the black makeup off this man's face. In the dream, I think I hold Al Jolson down because if I can't detach him from skin that looks like my skin, I at least want his eyes to stop glowing from beneath it. But the further I push his face down into the deepest parts of the water, I am only left to search the water for my own reflection, which looks dark, darker than I've ever been. So dark, it creeps along the water's surface like a shadow's dancing limbs. And then, as I lean closer to the water, I feel Al Jolson's suit snap itself empty, and I am not holding a body anymore. And then I wake up, and in the darkness of my real-life bedroom, I can't see my own hands. 4. Most of the black people I know knew that woman was white from the moment we heard her stumbling her way through that interview. Can't say much for what the eyes know. There are many ways to look back and look black and be black, so I just can't call it. Some of my skin folks sure did call it, though. Some of them, the ones from places that got no sun, insisted that they could tell a bad tan when they saw one. The black women I know said they knew the whole time, because if she was black, no one would let her go out the house with their hair looking a mess like it was. But hey, she was president of the NAACP, and that CP still stands for colored people, last I checked. But also, it was the NAACP in Spokane, Washington. I was in Spokane, Washington once. The black people were so invisible that other people would attempt to walk straight through us. So it's tough to tell, I guess. But even given every benefit of the doubt in regards to aesthetics, I knew the woman claiming to be black was actually not black when the interviewer asked her, "Are you actually African American?" And she said, I don't understand the question. 5. Al Jolson lost a lung when he contracted malaria during a tour entertaining troops during World War II. In 1950, he returned from a tour of Korea, and doctors told him that brown dust and dirt had blanketed his remaining lung, overwhelming him with exhaustion and breathing difficulties. While playing cards in a hotel room, his heart, quaking from a loss of oxygen, began to attack his body. His last words were, "Oh, I think I'm going." But sometime before that, before even his insides were caked with brown, Jolson said, "When I die, I'll be forgotten." 6. It is Black History Month, and everyone is deciding now would be a good time to admit that they, too, once wore blackface in college, at a party, trying to dress up like a rapper or a pop star or some actor from a sitcom. It was the 80s, after all, except when it was the 90s, except when it was the 2000s, except when it was last month. Some people on the internet know that blackface is bad, but don't seem to be entirely sure why. It's just one of those things people shouldn't do. I wonder about the benefits and failures of this, how far the country has gotten laying down the framework for societal do's and don'ts while not confronting history, if it is possible to ground a true behavioral shift without attacking the root of blackface, the fact that there will always be an audience wanting a blackface but not necessarily a black person. The problem with approaching history in America is that too many people measure things by distance and not impact. "When I die," Jolson said, "I'll be forgotten." On a stage at a press conference with his wife, the politician who put on blackface to dress as Michael Jackson in the 80s fields a question about whether or not he can moonwalk. He insists he can, and then turns to his wife, who tells him now is not an appropriate time to break out the old dance. And despite the absurdity, I find myself wanting to see him do it. 7. And since we are talking about Michael, friends, if you choose to read on beyond this and beyond the next handful of pages after this, this is in the book that's about black performance, by the way, you will come, obviously, you will come to read me, sorry for the spoiler alert, but yeah, this is obviously in the, because the book is about like minstrelsy in some ways. Anyway, you will come to see me eager to tell you a story about the night Michael Jackson died. It is as spectacular as any moment in any room where a song comes on that enough people know, and the singing of that song is uneven but loud enough to be harmonious. What I leave out of that story, I will tell here, how, in the dead heat of a swelling summer night, people donned leather jackets and wore wigs with wet and cascading curls falling over their eyes. Some wore giant sunglasses or gold chains. How, with so many eras of the Michael Jackson aesthetic represented, no one went for the young Afroed Michael Jackson with his dark skin. How, in that moment, it occurred to me that blackness was always part of the performance within the American scope of Michael Jackson, his looks defined either by it or the absence of it. And it never felt more clear to me than in the basement on the night he died, where no white people felt the need to paint their faces to get a point across, even when dressed in all of his gold, all of his sweat, all the life he gave. 8. It is said that Al Jolson truly loved black people, that he wanted, in many ways, to form a closeness with black people in every corner of him they influenced, from music to language to dance. It is true that he gave black people places to perform, even if they had to join him on stage while his face was covered darker than any of their faces. At his funeral, black performers lined up to pay respects, tap dancers and background singers and jazz composers. It can be said that the very presence of a white person in the world of jazz fostered a type of closeness with black people in their lives in that era, where dependency and artistic exchange was more high stakes than it is today. I have never seen Al Jolson cry while singing the song Mammy, but black jazz composer Noble Sissle says there was no sight like it. What Jolson had that went away in the eras after his was the palpable and physical presence of passion, before being cool was what sold. Sissel says, Al Jolson cried while singing Manny, and it was one of the most beautiful things he'd ever seen. A single tear rolling down Jolson's face while crooning the old lyrics about black servitude, a woman who leaves her family to care for another. The tear streaking through Jolson's black makeup and creating a clear border, who Jolson was and who he was dreaming himself to be. 9. What do you have to say about the people who do not have the option for removal but still choose to love themselves anyway? What about the removal of the people who choose to love themselves? What about love anyway? What about the removal of people who do not have the option? What about love, the people who choose removal? What about the still people who do not have the option to love? What do you have to say about removal? What say you about options? What about the people, the people, the people removed? 10. The other movie poster for The Jazz Singer is an artistic rendering of a white Al Jolson standing with his arms extended, smiling widely. Behind him, there is a detached and equally wide grinned face of the blacked-up Jolson, and I wish you would talk more about how frightening it all is. By you, I suppose I mean anyone, but let's say I mean you, non-black reader or scholar of history. I wish we could get down to the bare bones of it all and talk about how blackface, beyond everything else, is such a horrifying look. When done with careful precision, the way it was done in the old days, in the black and whites, black and white films interest me most when I think about how darkness is a currency. It is said that black is not a color, but the absence of color. Yet, in a film with no color, that absence is how one knows there is potential for a shade. When white performers covered their faces with black paint in black and white films, and when they donned thick, nappy black wigs of hair, from behind a screen, all a viewer can witness is the whites of their eyes and the brightness of their lips, peeling back occasionally and giving way to a blade of white teeth. It is the kind of vision that stuck with me as a child, watching from a hallway floor and peering into the room of my grandmother, who fell asleep with some classic movie channel network playing. These black people were unlike any I knew, all standing in a chorus of shadows but for the small bursts of white leaping out from their mouths or their open eyes. I looked at myself in the mirror with the lights off the next morning, just to see if I'd vanished. I smiled and opened my eyes as wide as I could, and yet I was still there. 11. This, I'm going to skip the first part of 11 because it's a YouTube comment verbatim of someone who was like, Al Jolson wasn't racist because he like sang black people songs on stage. Which, sure. So that's the first part of 11. The rest of 11. The thing I find myself explaining most vigorously to people these days is that consumption and love are not equal parts of the same machine. To consume is not love, and ideally, love is not rooted solely in consumption. So it is true that to flatten Jolson's life and career to his blackface performances is slightly easier to do when not considering some nuances around era and intention. It could be that Jolson thought this was the way to introduce black art to a country that seemed to want real parts of black people, but in so many ways, that same country is still spinning its wheels in that same mud. How to love the marginalized people who create what America is so infatuated with consuming. Few people suggest that despite Jolson's intentions, there almost certainly had to be a better way. One that, ideally, didn't center himself or this particular brand of performance, a brand that undoubtedly relied on foolish stereotypes, stereotypes that reduced American blackness to its simplest, most monolithic form. Al Jolson was romantic precisely because people knew that underneath he was still white. It is true that some black performers of the day had an appreciation for Jolson, but it is also true that Jolson's very presence in front of white audiences made it easier to consume the idea of black entertainment without presenting anything that might offer some feeling or affection towards black life. And it occurs to me that all the conversations about appropriation now are often wrong. So many people want to reduce it to a series of moves. Who can sing what song or play what instrument? Or the red or dance that way. Katy Perry wears gold teeth in a music video, and I suppose that is cashing in on the residue of blackface's most intricate trick. All these things are worth examining, but not from a far distance. This is how Jolson's legacy has survived its complications, by people talking about how he sung black songs to white audiences and introduced black musicians to the world, or people talking about his black friends, or the time he ate with black artists in restaurants that refused to serve them otherwise. All those things are are part of a portrait, but when zoomed in, the question I always want to ask of Jolson is if there was a better way, or another person, or another song to sing. What use is it introducing a black performer to white audiences if the white audiences themselves still don't want anything to do with black people? 12. At the Halloween party, and at the frat party, and once on High Street spilling out of some bar after a football game or a basketball game, and at the work party, and one time among the good liberals of the Northeast during a trip to the theater, which clashed with some kind of college outing, and the streets turned into a shouting match between a black person and a person who was only black for that night, and the temporary black yelled, "I'm just trying to honor," and then I heard nothing else. And oh, I can't forget the time at the poetry open mic, where the white reader read a poem about how they sometimes wanted to be black, and every time they said the word black, they ran their fingers along their face. And I guess the whole thing about being a tourist within a culture is that you can take whatever benefits you most for a few hours. And oh yeah, the toga party on Hudson that one year was pretty wicked, I guess. And I think there's a point where desire intersects with impulse, and that is where I want to meet you, person who is perhaps right now painting your face with a color that is not your color. And I must know what parts of the people I love that you want. And I feel like this isn't just about skin anymore, is it? No. We could talk all day about what skin affords and what it doesn't afford. And so I feel like this is about that which rests outside the grasp but can become clearer for a night. And what I'm really asking is about how lonely all of you are and how many cells might one need to fit into that loneliness. And listen, I have been consumed by the best parts of my ghost some nights, and those are the nights I don't want to end, and I want you to hear clearly what I am saying. And what I am saying is that it is possible to hate a person so much that you want to consume every part of them. 13. It ends the way it begins. Al Jolson's face contorting, the way his eyes widen while he sings songs. Historians say that if you watch a young Jackie Wilson, you can see that he was influenced by Jolson, and it is true. The way Wilson's lips stay pushed out even when the long note is faded. The way he allows his eyes to bulge so a viewer can get a glimpse of the way they dart in each direction. Like Jolson, Wilson was unashamed to overextend the performance of passion. The way Jolson would writhe, even while sitting. The theatrics of the best black rock and rollers, some say, stuffed into a white body ahead of its time. Jolson's very first film before the jazz singer made him a star was a 10-minute short called A Plantation Act. It was a sound-on-disc short film set on a sparse plantation background. Jolson, in a tattered rag of a shirt covered by striped overalls, is painted black, his arms and face covered. He sings three happy tunes. It is not particularly memorable to most fans of Jolson, who had come to believe that the jazz singer was his first film. I saw it only once, when it was a bonus feature on a re-release of The Jazz Singer that came out in the mid-2000s. The story behind it was that the technicians had to surgically repair the soundtrack disc to get it to play with the film. None of the songs sung in A Plantation Act were by black singers or sung in an attempt to get black singers to the forefront of cultural consciousness. And after a while, Jolson's white face can become his black face. Later in his career, it's almost as if he couldn't separate his white facial theatrics from his black ones. And in the shadows of black and white films, after seeing him in blackface, a viewer might have to look closely at the white Jolson to make sure he'd gotten all of it off. The same way, a viewer might have to look closely at the black performers who came directly after him to see through the ways he inspired their looks or their energy. And I suppose that's what people are not looking for when they look at Al Jolson, his foolish and flawed pursuit of complete immersion until every line was blurred, until he maybe got back to the silence of his home, looked at himself in the mirror, and put all the makeup back on. Thank you. That was the first time I ever read that out loud. It's like pretty new. As evidenced by the fact that I referenced Black History Month. The Black History Month, that is still somehow happening. Despite every attempt to make it feel like whatever Black History Month shouldn't feel like. Does anyone know the first single by A Tribe Called Quest? No one? The first single by A Tribe Called Quest is called Left in the Raw in El Segundo. And it's just like really kind of absurd narrative about Q-Tip taking a road trip from New York to California, and then the process losing his wallet, and then turning around to get it. It's like a novel, and it's stuffed into this 3-minute song, and it's really absurd in general. For like, it's absurd for a lot of reasons, but it's also absurd because it's just like, you tell Q-Tip had never been to El Segundo in real life, and he was just kind of like imagining this place. And I thought that was really fascinating. Among many other things, I thought for a lead single for a rap group in the 90s, early 90s, to lead with this like whimsical bullshit about a fake wallet loss and an excursion to retrieve it. Anyway, this is from the second chapter. Go ahead, Murray. I admit I lost my wallet in another city one time, and I did turn back to get it in West Texas, leaving Odessa after reading the book Friday Night Lights in some late teen haze and insisting that I must see the town. The thing about Odessa, Texas is that it is really a desert. I mean, I'm not saying there's nothing else there, but I am saying that at one time, the town became rich from oil, and then the oil left. So you maybe can imagine what I mean when I say there is a big sky and a lot of land with nothing on it below. That's beauty, though, a kind of America that can make someone feel like the wide open spaces are calling them and all of that. That is, when not factoring in the people, some of whom wave Confederate flags on their front porches, or glare ominously at an unfamiliar face in a gas station, when the person who owns the face puts their wallet on the counter with a bottle of sweet tea and a pack of peanut M&Ms, and then gets the hell out of town before anyone gets too suspicious. And who is to say, really, why I drove to Odessa? Except for the fact that it was summer, and I had nothing better to do, and I sure didn't have a job or much money except for gas and the occasional road snacks, and I just wanted to get the hell out of my town, and anywhere would have done. Like Q-Tip in his own story, I had the space and freedom and four wheels and a map that pointed me to a space I'd only heard of and imagined. And the thing about road trips is that nothing at the end of the journey can live up to the anticipation of the unseen destination once we arrive there. And so, in my haste to get out of Odessa, I drove an hour or two and reached into my pocket when passing the first fast food sign I'd seen in miles. And I wish Q-Tip would have gone on to describe the feeling that hits you when you realize you have lost your wallet or some other precious thing, the way shock begins in your legs and carves a home in your stomach for a while before even getting to the part of your brain that asks the "what do I do now" question. And I knew I'd left it in the gas station, and I knew I'd left the gas station in too much of a hurry, because once you've seen a harsh look in one too many small towns, you start to get a feeling for what might be on the other side of that look if you stick around too long. And yet, I did a complete U-turn, kicking up sand and dust as I sped back to the gas station where my wallet was most certainly waiting for me, and the person behind the counter handed it back over without a word, and I got in my old car and headed back east, and the muffler on that car was so loud, but instead of getting it fixed, I just got a louder stereo, and I fingered the leather seams of my newly retrieved wallet, and I laughed at the absurdity of it all, and then I remembered there's a song for this. Thank you all so much.
We've got a little bit of time for questions if anybody has them.